Blog Talk Radio.
There must be lights burning brighter somewhere. Got to be birds flying higher in a sky more blue. If I can dream of a better land where all my brothers walk hand in hand, tell me why, oh why, oh why can't my dream come true? Oh why? There must be peace and understanding sometime. Strong winds of promise that will blow away all the doubt and fear. If I can dream of a warmer sun where hope keeps shining, oh, heaven be one. Tell me why, oh, why, oh, why won't that sun appear?
Good evening. I'm Marcia Cook, and it's A Good Story is a Good Story. It is Wednesday, November 12th, and this is not my usual show. This is a very special show. I had to cancel yesterday's show. I'm sorry, and we will redo same-sex relationships after I come back in January. But today we've got a great show, and this was the last show, so we're saving the best for last year. So we have a great show tonight. We have Jack Remick and Dennis Muss. They're both very accomplished in writing and playwriting short stories, poets, everything. So I'm going to just put them right on, and I'm going to open the chat room, and we're going to see. Let me open the chat room. Okay. And then I'm going to see if it opens. Jack, I opened the chat room. Do you see it open?
Let's see. I can
might not
ready
be
to post something. Let me see.
Okay, because you have to scroll down after when you, and then you should see the chat room. But I'm going to let each of them introduce themselves. And first, I'll let Dennis. Hi, Dennis. How are you?
Hi, Marcia.
I'm so glad to have you on the show. And I want you to tell everybody just a few of the things about you, and then we're going to talk after we bring Jack out.
Well,
You've got a lot. You have a lot of things that you've done.
I've fortunate to have a couple novels come out this year. One was, the earliest one was The World's Smallest Bible, and the most recent one came out in October is Hush Now, Don't Explain. Prior to that, I had two collections of short stories in the past decade or so, and before that, I was a playwright and in the late 60s and early 70s off-Broadway. And sort of what I'm interested in talking about tonight.
Yeah, that's what we're going to talk about tonight, which I'm glad. I'm glad because I'm a screenwriter also, and I love that, and Jack is too. So Jack, we'll bring Jack out. Jack, how are you, Jack?
I'm real well, Marcia. Thanks
okay,
for having
good.
Us
did
on.
Okay, good. Did you see the chat room, or if it's not, it may not be
working? No, not yet, but it'll
okay.
Show up eventually.
You think so?
We'll
I don't know about that.
Well,
okay, we'll see.
So.
Bye.
Yeah, well, you know, I was really fascinated by Dennis's background, you know. For people who don't know who I am, I'm a writer,
yes, right.
A novelist, a poet, a short story writer, and former teacher. I don't teach much these days.
Yes,
but,
you do. You do.
In different ways, yeah.
Yes.
But I have, a few books out, most of them on Amazon, all of them basically from Coffeetown, except I have a few self-published things because I broke into that universe trying to figure out how to make it work. And then I got connected to Dennis through Coffeetown Press because they brought out his last book called Hush Now, Don't Explain, which is a marvelous novel. I haven't read anything like it in so long. So I was really pleased that we could get together on this show and sort of share some of what we know, with other writers. I know Dennis has a long history in the theater. And I was really fascinated by some of the things he said, and maybe, Dennis, you can pick this up here, about how you had used character development in the theater to lead you into a better understanding of characters
right.
in the novel.
Right.
How does that work? Tell us about that.
Well, as many things occur, you sort of put it together looking back on it. As it was occurring, as the transition from playwriting to short story writing and the novel writing occurred, I wasn't aware of the connection between the two, but it's a singular connection. And I want to start out by talking about what Fitzgerald says, and I strongly believe this. Scott Fitzgerald says, writers aren't exactly people. There are a whole lot of people trying to be one person.
And boy, is that ever the truth.
That is the truth.
You know, I often say stuff like
definitely.
That. Go ahead. Yeah.
No, go ahead, please.
Well, I've tried to tell my own writers that when I was teaching these courses, I would say, look, it's really hard to be a writer, but it's easy to be an actor. All you have to do is be one character. But if you're a writer, you have to be all 16 of them, and that's why
right.
we're all crazy as
yeah.
hell.
That's right,
you know?
Probably. Yeah. We don't have our spouses. We should have our spouses in here to see how we are, how we really are
yeah.
in real life.
And the thing that when I was, when you're at that age of 15 or so, and your identity is really an acquired identity. It's really not you. It's been made by, it's been fabricated by people who love you and given you your name, and you're responding to them in the best way you know how and thinking you're pleasing them. And so when I was about 15 in a small mill town, I watched on the screen, local movie house, I watched Streetcar Named Desire, and I saw Marlon Brando become on that screen an iconic performance, and I looked at that and I walked out of that movie house and I said, my God, I can be somebody other than who I am.
Right.
And that was liberating.
That is, because, you know, we can.
Well, look,
we can do that.
How did that figure, I'm maybe jumping the gun here. You may not be finished with that, but I've been just fascinated by your religious background. How did you get from a small mill town in, Pennsylvania, into the church to playwriting to novel writing? I mean, that's quite a journey.
Well, part of it is connected to being... your identity being acquired and fabricated and molded by people very strong in your family, and I saw that, and I felt, I really did feel like there was a total recognition that I thought I didn't quite fully understand it, but I thought here was this actor who had gone inside a character. And had become that character.
Yeah.
And but then I went into college and I was studied as a pre-ministerial student and I was preaching and I went into seminary, and they have in seminary the most important thing in seminary is called your Midler sermon. It's in the end of your second year and you have to get up there and preach before the whole seminary body, and this is a Princeton Theological Seminary in Princeton, New Jersey. And I went up there and did my sermon, and after it was done, the professor called me in and did a colloquy on it, and he said, I have to give you an F. You failed it. Oh. And I said, why? And he said, Marlon Brando doesn't belong in the church.
Oh, wow.
And he
oh, wow.
said, you know, wow. Dennis, what are you doing? You were like your Marlon Brando up there. And,
wow.
and so it was at that point I knew that I didn't belong in seminary. And at the time, Peter Falk, and I know you know who Peter
yes.
Falk is.
Oh, yeah.
Great.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And Susan Plachette were doing a performance of Streetcar Named Desire at MacArthur Theater right next to the seminary campus. And I began to spend every night there for several weeks and watched Peter Falk play Stanley Kowalski. And one thing I learned about it, that's when I became interested in Stanislavski and Strasberg, is that Peter Falk, I would watch him before he would go on each night to perform, and he would be walking around campus preparing, getting inside his character, what Stanislavski calls emotion memory, trying to find within himself who this person might be.
Wow.
And at, when that was happening, of course, you'd see him, and I knew him at that point, but you would not dare say, Peter, how are you doing tonight? Because you knew what he was doing. It was almost like a religious experience.
Right.
So
yeah.
That's what happened.
Do you find that your religious background has any influence on what you try to do as a writer within the work itself?
That's an interesting question.
Yeah. Well, I hope so.
That is really an interesting question. As you probably know from my writing, I did have a crisis of faith, and I no longer am a believer. And I think that whole movement through those years certainly brought that together. But I don't know how to answer that, Jack.
Can you imagine though if people from the past had seen how the movies and how plays and how the language and nudity, even on television, it's such a different world than it was then. You know, and when you see a movie now, some of them are okay, but, years ago, most of the movies, they were just putting them out, but they were good because they had so much more characterization than they do now, because sometimes you don't even like the character or you don't care about it. I don't know if either of you, have either of you seen the HBO from Olive, it's Olive Kitteridge?
No, I haven't.
Tom Hanks produced it.
Go ahead.
It's about Olive Kitteridge. It's through her 25 years, and it's so wonderful. It's like you're watching something that you haven't seen in so long. And then I went and I bought the book, and it was a Pulitzer Prize winner, Elizabeth Strad, and it's such a wonderful. You haven't seen anything like this lately. It's unbelievable.
It was
HBO. It's 4 hours.
Is this the one with Frances McDormand in it?
Yes.
Yeah, I've heard about it, but
I haven't had
the chance.
It's unbelievable because you're watching this and you are so into the characters. And you actually know about the characters. And it's so rare that you actually find that these days where the people, because I see everybody, I'm sure you do, they come out with books every 5 minutes. I mean, you see, so they say, I'm working on a book. Another 2 weeks later, my book is finished. And I'm thinking, what is wrong with me? My characters just can't come out of me like that because it takes me time. And I have to make sure that they're right. And, a lot of us are, we're overprotective of what we put out there. But it's amazing now what goes out every 5 minutes. And I'm thinking, how can you know your characters so well?
Well, Dennis, how do you react to that? I mean, you don't write very fast. I mean, it seems.
No,
right?
I don't.
Or you just don't publish much. Which is it in your view?
He's probably hard on himself. Are you hard on yourself? Probably hard. You probably.
Oh, yes. And, and to go back to that getting into character and moving for the transition from. And that's one other thing I want to say to give another window to this discussion is that. One of the things I've discovered when I was doing plays, there were a number of actors that I met that really lived for somebody to give them a new character.
Yeah.
And that I didn't fully understand that until after a while is that they really, truly, a number of them that were into it felt that they were not, they really were empty. Until they had
a new character to play.
Somebody else to play.
Right.
And they, and I can't wait to, one has said, I can't wait to see who I'm going to become. in the next production.
Well, some of them, some of them do say they take it home with them, and some of them say that when they have lunch, if they're in the character, I've seen a lot of performers talk about the fact that when they're doing a character, if they're at lunch and they don't take off their makeup, they are that character. They're still them.
And the thing that I think that where it is for me now is that there is a fragility of identity. That I am aware of personally and I think one of the things that drives me to write as I continue to write is not too unlike what I just said about this actor or we talked about Pirandello's six characters in search of an actor, wanting to find somebody to write their lives so they can live.
Right.
Do you think that being a writer, Dennis, does being an actor make you a better writer? Should we all go in and take an acting course? What do you feel about that?
On what basis can I say that, you know, other than my own experience? But
okay.
It's certainly how, for example, writing this character and the narrator in most recent book, who's a woman, right, a young woman. I have to say, when I would come up to my study and to begin writing, I would really prepare myself, not unlike I would if I were going on the boards or on the stage.
Yeah,
I'll be darned.
Peter Falk walking around the campus to get inside this character. You know, one of the wonderful quotes from Jim Harrison, who's written a couple of novels with woman narrators, says there are some doors a man can only open by being a woman. And
yeah.
So that was sort of the drive for me to create that character, you know. And how do you do that? You know, how do you do that without being a woman? Well, Jack,
you've done that in your book.
Exactly.
Yeah. I've done that several times. You know, I tried to do it in Gabrielle and the Widow.
You did. Well, you tried. You did a fabulous job.
You know,
you did it.
The way I did that was when I was doing those blog tour things, people would ask me, how can you write from a woman's point of view if you're not a man? And I say, well, these are some of the traps of American realism. You know, American realism says if it hasn't really happened to you, you can't write about it. Well, that precludes
everything.
See, but
that's not true. Right. I think that's not true. Right, exactly.
Right.
And, you know,
yeah.
I mean, look, at the thing is, when I'm writing, why they don't ask a woman if she's writing a male character she's got into. I mean, why is that? It is, you know, that's one of the things. When I was writing my screenplays, I always used, when I started doing screenplays, I used Max Irving as my name because I felt like there were more men that were doing screenwriting and I just wanted to fit in. And then it was hard for me to swear and do things like that, but then I certainly learned, and as Jack would know, in my Virginia Templeton, I got it together.
Yes, you did.
But, yes, but it took a while. It wasn't really easy for me. But, you know, they do not say that to women. They don't say to women, how can you write a male character, but they always say to men,
right,
how do you write? But there are a lot of men,
such as they can write women wonderfully.
Well,
so finally, the answer to that question is, we're all people, we have certain kinds of emotions, and in these situations, you know, people are going to do this and say this and feel this no matter what their sex.
And so it has
to do far more with an expression of a total humanity than it does with an expression of a female or a male character.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's
because you're
the
writing
way
the story as you
that.
See it. You're writing it as you see it, and
exactly.
the people are coming alive, which is what you hope.
Yep.
But I think there is a lot of that, you know. But I do think, like what you just said before, I think that, you know, when you're writing on things that you haven't experienced, I think you can do that because you take it from everything you observe out in the world.
Yeah.
You know men,
yeah.
you know women,
yeah.
you know children, you know grandparents, whatever, and you see how they act. I'm sure that both of you watch people like I do, We all do, that are writers. You watch people, and that's where you get your characters. Not specifically one character, but you take from a lot of things that you've seen. I would think that you both do that. I do it.
Exactly. Well, you know, when Dennis was doing, when in Hush Now, Don't Explain, he has a male protagonist and a female protagonist, and he does both with equal ease, you see, really fascinating, which tells me that it's far deeper than being stereotyped by a role, and has far more to do with how you can delve into the being of the character and find what that character is and what that character wants and what that character does without being trapped by realism. You know, there's a new genre out now called transrealism. Is that right? Transrealism? I think that's what it is. But it started with Philip K. Dick and some of his work. And it's a whole notion about, well, you take realism as the base and then you embellish it in this other imaginary or imaginative way. So he, in effect, invents a new genre, which I really liked a lot. In my last few books, I have taken that notion without realizing that I was in fact following in the footsteps of a master, you know. And so it's just this new realism thing is saying, wait a minute.
Well, it does
you do
come
not
from somewhere,
to.
You know. It is. It's called living life, and that's you get characters. I mean, I do love to talk to different people, and I think I learned so much. And you learn the dialogue. That's how you do dialogue, is when you talk to a lot of people, or when you listen to a lot of people.
Right.
And you know, and they don't talk. You know, exactly. People do not talk grammatically correct. So you know, when you do a screenplay, for me, it's mentally easier, because I'm not so worried about my editing as much as I do if I'm writing a book, because then I'm thinking about the tenses, because when you write screenplays, it's all present. And or if you do a flashback or something, but you're right in the moment. When you're writing a story, you're somewhere else. And for me is difficult.
Yeah.
It's easier for me to
be. Well, Dennis, let me ask you another question. You and I have talked a little bit about this. One of your favorite authors is Pirandello, and especially Six Characters in Search of an Author. What do you find? What's fascinating about that for you as a writer, as an actor, as a father, as a person? You know, why is that such a big deal for you?
Well, again, it goes back to sort of what we were saying is that when I read that play, and I thought. It was just a confirmation of what I had begun to experience in the theater, that these roles were the lifeblood of these people who continue to look for a new play when they're done with the other one.
Yeah.
And here are these six characters, you know, and they say we want to live. We don't live unless we can find an author who's going to give us our script. But the authors who were doing it, they didn't want to do the tragedy of what life is.
There was
a combination.
Yeah.
Well, no, we got to have a little bit of tragedy, but there has to be some of this other too, you know.
Yeah.
But that's not who we are.
Right, and I think when you're writers, you want to write. And if you're not writing, you feel lonely because you don't have your characters with you. And even though you could be sitting in a room listening to somebody else, and I'm sure both of you have felt this, all of a sudden something about your character clicks in your head. You go, oh, my God, that one does, you know. By watching something else triggers my mind. I wonder, does it do that for both of you? When you see
I think that what you're saying, Marcia, is that maybe I have this the wrong way, but in some specific gesture or word or something in a person you're observing, they unlock something that has a more universal connection, and you realize that while you're not going to exactly duplicate what they have just said or done, it has done something to you. And I almost want to say in an archetypal way that you find inhabits your character And I think, Dennis, you're talking about inhabiting characters, aren't you? Isn't that one of the ways you deal with this? You get up in the morning and you go up to the room and you sit down with honor and you say, okay, what am I going to wear today? And it's not honor saying that, right? I mean,
that's
you find
true.
This
that's
universal
connection.
Yeah, this archetypal connection. Yeah, this archetypal connection that frees you up from the realism and lets you dive into this deep, deep stuff that's in us. I'm writing a novel right now called The Biology of Desire, and one of the big things that I'm trying to figure out is what does it mean to be human? In other words, in a world where we could conceivably generate human beings through parthenogenesis, which apparently is very possible, are we still human if, in fact, we have in the past defined human as being a combination of an X chromosome and a Y chromosome? What happens if you do away with it? Are we still human? And I really get balled up in that sometimes. Do you have a take on that? I mean, what's human?
I think it probably depends on how the person is writing it and how they're feeling it. I mean, I think to give your characters human qualities, is that something what you're talking about? Your characters come out of you, but they're not really things that we may want to do or even do. It's just the fact that, you know, I think sometimes people think, like for me when I first started, I sometimes felt like, oh, if I said something, it would be a reflection on me, but it's really not about me. That's how you get to write better, is when you realize you're writing a character. You're not writing you, and you have to let yourself go and be free. That's hard to do.
You run into that with Virginia, don't you? With Virginia, Madison, Montgomery.
Yes, I do. And one of my big problems is, which I figured out, I think when I was writing I decided to go back to Marcia Casper Cook, and when I did that, I can't write Virginia. This is not, it's not coming out of me, it came out of Madison. And so, I mean, this has become psychological, I think. And I do feel, for me, it was easier. And I think that Virginia, I think a lot of times in my head I'm not like Virginia, but sometimes I would like to be like Virginia because she just does whatever she wants and doesn't care, you know. And so I think somewhere probably it came out of me, but now because if I write as Marcia Casper Cook, it's not working. So I have to think about, I know I made a mistake in changing it again because it's amazing. If I write as somebody else, I'll be able to do it.
I guess it's psychological. Do you ever write with a pseudonym? Dennis, do you write with a pseudonym in order to get a different cut on a character?
Yep. Do you do that?
I never have done that. No, I haven't.
I don't either. But Marcia does that. She writes kids' stories. She writes these erotica novels, and she writes the screenplays and other kinds of things. And I marvel at that sometimes.
It's hard, though. It's hard to be me sometimes because it's hard to then. I do like screenplays the best. I love movies. I love screenplays. I think writing screenplays is a lot of fun, but it is very difficult to get them produced. It's a lot. It's all about money, and that's when the problems occur.
Yeah. Marcia, there's a question I want to ask you. Do you, in as much as you do so many characters, do you ever catch yourself being one of those characters in a public situation?
No, I do not.
That's a good question. No. I mean, like being a bad tipper, that sort of thing, get away with it because you're in a character.
No, I actually don't. I never write. It's really weird because I do write, whenever I write a screenplay, I do write screenplays with like 12 characters. I just find them all different. And even in as many, I've written 12 screenplays, but I don't feel like any of my characters are alike, which is, you know, it could be because I do like to talk to a lot of people. I did it even when I was a small child. My mother would tell me that I would be talking to neighbors when I was 3 years old, walking all around the block. And I think that's why whenever I do a story or screenplay, I find it difficult to do just a couple of characters. Like some people really can do a heavy story with like 3 or 4 characters, and that's all they use. I can't do that. It seems more characters come into it. You've read my screenplay, you know. There was a lot of people in it, and that's how it's probably because something inside of me. But no, I don't think I feel that I'm like any of my characters.
Yeah, Dennis, when you're doing a reading, like you've given a couple readings recently, like the one in New York and so forth, How do you approach that reading? Do you approach it as a performer? Do you approach it as a character? Do you approach it as a member of the audience to whom you're speaking? How do you get into voice for a reading like that?
You know, this I approach it with great trepidation. It's one of the hardest things for me in the world. The best of all possible worlds for me would be simply to stay where I am and let somebody else do it for me. You know,
just
it's just so hard.
Yeah.
It's just so hard. And the stress that goes into any kind of appearance, thank goodness feel like I'm with friends tonight. Making it a little easier, and I know I am. I know.
You know, look, you know, I think that you sometimes you just can't look at it that way, you know, because you have so much to offer. I think you don't probably realize how much you have to offer and how interesting you really are. And I think if you just let go, like I know for myself, the last thing in the world I ever wanted to do was even when I was first started, I didn't want to be on TV. I didn't want to be on the radio. And people said, you have to be on a radio show. I go, I don't think this is going to happen. I really just want to be behind the scenes because I felt like much more comfortable writing. But then after I did a couple shows, I've done like 500. So, I mean, but it is, I understand what you're saying because it's, even on the radio, it's still different than being out and trying to, read to people and have them just focus on you.
Yeah, well, I ask that question because I do poetry readings from this new book called Satori. And I
how do you feel when you're doing it?
Pardon?
How do you feel when you're doing it?
I cannot just pick up the book and go out and read it. In other words, I have to, first of all, find a thread in the book that I want to bring out that particular night.
Yeah.
And then I have to sit down with the words and get to know them again. And I rehearse and rehearse and rehearse until the point I get to the reading, and it's almost like the words on the page are immaterial because I'm inside the poems. Does that make sense to you at all? It's like a rehearsal. It's a preparation. And when I finally do it, then I'm able to be in the words. And you know, one of the things that I know from other writers and musicians and things like that, a friend of mine, John Verrill, who was a composer pianist, he said, I played some fantastic young pianist playing something for him, and he listened to it, and he said, they're like so many of these brilliant young technicians, they play all the notes and none of the music. And I'm thinking about my poetry in that. You know, most poets just read the words. They don't read the music in the words that gives them the cadence and the rhythm and the beat and all of that wonderful flow that comes from being in the zone, right? And I wonder, and this is a wonder, is that the way you feel when you're in a character, in a play, becoming that character?
Yes, absolutely.
So I'm becoming,
absolutely,
in those moments, I'm becoming Jack the poet, right?
Yeah.
That's the role I'm
right.
Yeah. Go ahead.
There are times when my wife, when she goes to work every day and I go up to my study, and there are times often when I come back downstairs at the end of the day and I sit across from the table and she looks at me and she says, where are you? You know, where are you?
No, I get that. I understand that.
And really, it's sort of like, who are you? You know?
I think my husband
I understand that, Jack.
I do too, because my husband sometimes will say, he says, oh, look at it, he goes, there's smoke coming from your head. What's going on with you? You know, where are you right now? Because I think that's what we do. You know, we don't realize these things sometimes until somebody points it out to us that we do.
Well, it's in a whole different world, right? It's where we are.
I think we are. I think you're right. And sometimes when you're not liking what you're writing, you want to get out of that world. And then when you go back in it, you go, oh, I kind of like it.
Don't burn it. Don't burn it if you don't like it. Because you never know where the real truth is.
I know.
Jack, I want to ask you a question.
Dude.
Talk about, if you can, the power, the uniqueness, the strength that goes into your poetry. One can't read your poetry without feeling as if they're in some very strong current, and that comes through. And
yeah.
and it's a very deep one at that, and
yeah.
swift one. And how can you talk about that as you're being a poet, as strong a poet as you are, and also as strong a fiction writer as you are? How do you work those two together? Does one pull you more than the other?
Well, Dennis, one of the things that I found, well, first of all, let me go back to the beginnings of my poetic universe, all right? In the beginning, I was very much a traditionalist poet, writing in rhyme and meter, and I
yeah.
understood all of that, and I worked in it for a long time. And then I realized that poetry is more than rhyme and meter, that
yes.
that's kind of an archaic approach to it.
Uh-huh.
And so I devised a set of poetic principles that I call my own poetics. And they have to do with, I think that every line has a rhythm to it, it has a beat to it, and then finally, long towards morning, it has a narrative storyline.
Yeah.
So you have to first think about the words as something more than a reality that you're trying to expose, but you're trying to use the words. Words are just an approximation to this deep emotional river that you're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, the opening of Satori, the first poem is, I took first communion on the steps of the jazz cellar, too young to buy my own booze, too dumb to steal it. I heard Rexroth rip the nation naked over the beat of conga drums and horns crystal in the night. You know, and so each of those, you can't tell where they turn the way you do if you were writing in rhyme and meter, you see.
Right.
Because it has to do with the breath line, it has to do with the cadence, it has to do with the rhythm, it has to do with the beat.
But,
and
right,
finally,
and because when you say that,
you learn
your voice,
how to
your
sing.
Voice,
you,
but your voice
you
is
learn
different
how to
when you
sing
do that.
The, you
realize
well,
that
what
your
you
voice
do is you learn how to
poetic.
You learn
when
how
you,
to sing
like
the vowels. So you
yeah.
can only sing vowels,
yeah.
you see. I took first communion
yeah,
on
because
the steps
how you're doing it.
Of the jazz cellar. You can only sing the vowels because
mm-hmm.
every vowel is a liquid and the
mm-hmm.
consonants have points of articulation. If you can't sing a T, you can
mm-hmm.
sing the off-glide. So once you discover that, then you realize that the words are just an approximation, a very poor approximation of this really deep emotional thing that you are trying to get to. And I think
yes.
I call it the poetics of prose.
You know, were you this
you
way
know?
When you were a teenager?
Pardon?
Were you this way
was
when you were
what?
A teenager? Did you think about things and were your thoughts were very heavy and strong Did you when you were a teenager? Do you
yes.
feel like that's coming
you know,
from there?
Yes, I felt, well, this is kind of an admission I'm going to confess here for a moment. I always felt I always felt that I was out of culture. You know, I mean, I didn't know what my culture was because,
yeah.
you know, I wasn't this and I wasn't that and I was never, and so I just sort of realized that one of the really beautiful things in life, and I discovered poetry fairly early, one of the most beautiful things in life is the rhythm within a line. You know, if you think of Hopkins, you know, the world is charged with the grandeur of God. You know, I mean, holy, how can you not be impressed just with that cadence and that rhythm, see?
Mm-hmm.
So I had always been influenced by that. And then I got sidetracked when I started reading in the existential world, you know, Sartre and Camus and even
mm-hmm.
Nietzsche, you know, trying to read what in the heck are these guys all about?
Yeah.
And I'd always came back to poetry because of the music.
Yeah.
You know, the music is just so, and that's what, in a way, Dennis, that's what connected me so deeply to Hush, Now, Don't Explain. Because while you're writing this story along the line of, you know, these two characters looking for identity in their past and discovering who and what they are, underneath that all, you've got this wonderful thing about music and jazz and what it means and how you get to it. And first there's, I think you said, there's the rhythm and then there's the tune, or first there's the beat and then
right,
there's the tune.
Right.
That's very much what poetry is all about.
Mm.
You know, first find the beat, boom, 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 boom. I took first communion on the steps of the jazz cellar, too young to my own boo. You know, I mean, you get that in there, and pretty soon you're in what you can call it the white flow. You know, and that's why.
And that's what's
okay.
right, exactly. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is, you know, everybody does have their own style, and, you know, sometimes you change somewhat, but sometimes when you go back to your roots, I think, it, you know, because you're actually saying what you were doing even when you were, you know, out of school. because well, your book reflects that.
Well, I think, Marcia, that every work, if you're a real, I don't want to use the word real, but if you think of yourself as an inventor and a craftsperson, mm-hmm. then every work that you do, you produce it at that point in time that's at the pinnacle of your possibilities and your technique.
Yeah.
And so you look back at it and you say, well, it's not where I am now, but it's pretty good for where I was then.
Yeah,
and
we
often find that our ideas often outstrip our technique. So we have to wait for our techniques to catch up.
That's a great way.
That's
to
why
look
you
at
can't
it.
Quit studying. You can't stop studying. You've got to keep reading and looking.
Well, that's really
trying.
The truth. And also, you know, when I always tell a lot of people that are listening, you know, I say, like, listen to shows, not only mine, listen to other shows, because I think when you stop learning, you can't write anymore. You have to keep learning. I mean, you have to listen to other people, and you have to hear their, you know, how they do it. And sometimes you become closer with people because you realize we're all in the same world, that if you're not a writer, sometimes you don't understand, you know, because we are not. You're right. We're not the same. You know.
Right. Yeah.
And
Marcia,
what
is your biggest challenge in writing?
Me? Are you talking to
me
or Marcia?
No, Marcia.
Me? Oh, me?
Marcia, okay. Yeah.
Is myself. I'm the biggest challenge myself, because I write something and I go, and I'm always thinking it's not good enough, and then when I read it, I think maybe it is good enough, but then I just keep going. I do have a bad habit of thinking that I'm not as good as I should be, and whatever that means, I don't know what that means. Because when I see something on TV, I'm watching, I'm saying, I could do this, and I do it. But then I'm still thinking I can do better, and I'm not satisfied, and I think I stand in my
great.
Own way.
Yeah, that's good. I think that one of the things that Natalie Goldberg used to say, or I think she probably still says it, you'd go into her workshops, and she would say, get out of the way, you know, silence the noise. Get out of the way and let the characters work for you. Because if we try to manipulate the characters, I think that there are basically three stories, you know, in the universe that want to be told. One is the one that the ego wants to tell. I want to tell this story. Two, there's a story that really wants to be told, and that's the story the characters are trying to tell you when you get out of the way and let them speak.
Right.
And three is this god-awful thing out there that's in the audience's head or the reader's mind, and if you don't perfectly mesh with what they've got in their head, they put your book down and don't read it anymore. So kind of, you know, you have to satisfy without knowing all these people, you know, how in the world can I write a story that all these people could possibly like? You know, well,
I know, you're right,
can't.
I know. That's
you
true,
have
it does
to,
get in
you
the
have
way.
To settle for them.
And it's getting easier for them to do it now that everybody can write, you know, because I read yesterday that there are 600,000 self-published books already in line to be published next year.
And I will tell you,
that's unbelievable.
Yeah, but it's a huge problem because it ruins it for a lot of the good writers that have self-published, because a lot of these people are just writing to write, and they're just writing to see if they can make money, and they're writing so fast, and they have fans that don't read their books, and they say, like, oh, we love you, because they want to be in a group. They have no clue what the writer writes, but they want to be in, like, a group, and when they're in the group, they feel like they're having fun. But the writer thinks writer actually thinks now that they're fabulous, they're a great writer because they've not been rejected ever. And I cannot, I've said this many times, if you have never been rejected, this is not a good thing. You have to have some, you have to have rejection.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah. Well, you know,
no, if you're never
Moody,
rejected, you don't know.
Mentor.
You think you're perfect then. You think, oh, my God, what a writer, what an author I am.
Yeah,
Marcia, do you have
Jack
somebody
Moody.
Look at your work when you're done?
Yes. Yes. Oh, absolutely.
You
I have the same editor. Oh, yeah. Because when I do, he doesn't change my words. He makes them better, but he does. If there's a problem and I know it, I know he's going to find it, and he does. But he does not change my words, but he does, because grammatically I have issues. I cannot edit. But I always have him, the same one, because he knows how I write. You know, but I don't have a lot of other people read my work. When I'm done, I let him read it. Because what if I change it? You know, a lot of people keep having people read their work, but, you know, when you're done, but never done. But when you really are done, you want your editor to look at it.
Right.
Otherwise, you know, you could have, you know, you might not really like what you've done. I know I am very hard on myself, and I think, you know, I've been doing this a lot of years, but I've seen a lot of work that's really not good. I don't want to be that way. So I want whatever I put out to be right. You know, I am hard
on
myself.
Well, one thing on that line, Jack Moody, my mentor, the first real poet that I ever met, I asked him about this one. I said, you know, I keep sending stuff out and it keeps coming back. And he says, don't worry about it. He said, I get one acceptance for every 300 submissions.
See, that's great. Yeah,
this
see,
was
right,
in
you got to have it. Right.
This
yeah.
was in the heyday of, you know, all the literary magazines and this kind
yeah.
of stuff.
But, yeah.
you know, but it's the persistence that really matters as a writer.
Yeah.
Is
yeah.
how long can you go on a positive rejection? I used to say I can live for a year on a positive rejection.
Yeah.
Oh, I agree
you know,
with that.
We really like
yeah.
this, but, you know.
Yeah.
You know,
well, now because of self-publishing, though, I have a more, I'm freer because I just feel like, okay, fine, I'm going to sell, because I have been with three small publishers and decided to do them again myself. And so if I, the thought of having to wait 2-3 years to go to larger publishers, I don't want to do that again. I've been there, done that, and maybe someday, but I don't know, you know. It's hard to say, you know. I the fact of getting rejected doesn't bother me. It's just that writing all those letters again bothers me. That's what I hate. It's not
yeah,
the
yeah.
rejections as much as all the letters that go out. You know,
yeah, well,
that's
Dennis,
not...
Let me ask you a question about, you have now, Hush Now Don't Explain, coming from Coffeetown Press, but you had, you would have and could have, might have published it with Red Hen, right? But they... The publication date would have been so far in the future. Is that what I understand?
Yes, I don't know for certain, Jack. I mean, they
uh-huh.
had published, Red Hen had published two of my books, and but when they accepted the World's Smallest Bible, it took almost 7 years before it was released.
Yeah, that's
and,
a long time. Yeah.
And so I assumed that,
yeah.
you know, I made it.
Yeah, I mean, my God.
Jack knows
I really,
I'm 80 years old, so I, you know, I wasn't going to take the chance if somebody else came up and Coffeetown came up, and I said, oh, okay.
Yeah, because really, you don't want to wait like so many years. I mean,
well,
you
I
know.
Knew it would have been. They have a backlog, and what's happened is with that press is because they've been around so long, 20 plus years, is that increasingly. Because it's harder for established writers, particularly literary fiction and poets, to get published. So now they've gotten a lot of really established writers, and the rest of us benefit from that. But, you know, I knew it would be if they had accepted. I never sent it to them, but I knew it would be another 8 or 10 years out.
Well, on the other hand, that's kind of a really, that's a really good discipline, though. I mean, for other writers, if anyone out there is listening to this, you know, I mean, goodness gracious, if you have to wait 7 years, I mean, that's a real test of your patience and your
mental. Oh, that's a lot. That's a lot.
Everything, you know, how, you know, can I really, can I, you know, I mean, I think that's really an important point. You know, they like the book enough that they wanted to publish it, but they also like other things, and so you have to wait a little bit.
Right,
yeah, but
right.
We're in a me now time, and
right.
Oh, really?
You know, everything's now, me, instant everything, instant potatoes.
Right.
You know, well, now we've got instant books,
and so
writers
but the good
often
thing about
don't
that
have
is, you can go out and go talk about it after it, so it's not like 5 years ago that you wrote it, because in 5 years sometimes you change your, you know, how you might be writing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and that's a long time to wait 7 years. That is long, very long.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
even a couple, even 3 years.
The good thing, though, and I'm going to, you know, pass out an accolade here. If you look at the way Dennis wrote The World's Smallest Bible and you look at the way he wrote Hush Now, Don't Explain, you see a growth of a writer, but the first book, you know, is intact and pure and real unto itself and does not owe anything to the following book. Which means that you have accomplished something twice as many, you know, you have accomplished something twice. And it, the first one was not a learning process. I mean, it's clear to me that the style is every bit as mature and complicated in The World's Smallest Bible as the style is in Hush Now, Don't Explain. You know, so I think that's a marvelous example of what happens to a writer who listens to the discipline inherent in the writing and uses all of the techniques and skills and talents that are available to build something that is going to be there long after the flood, you know. I mean,
right. It is, but Jack, it's, you know.
Jack, I wanted to ask you, I wanted to happen while we were on. I wanted to ask you were going to talk about the difference of doing a quartet versus a single book.
Right, yeah.
Could you talk about that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah.
What I wanted to do, I knew I was going to write a quartet. I knew that because the story needed to be told in four volumes.
Yeah.
But what I didn't want to do was do something like, you know, I don't want to use Proust as an example, but, you know, that's all of those characters flow through all of those books, you know, and they come back and they go out. And I thought, I don't want to do that, but what do I want to do? So it took me a long time to figure out what to do. And so I realized that what I could do was, in fact, take an archetype and age the archetype. And so the first book is a bunch of teenagers, you know. The second book is young men trying to figure out what the hell is going on in the world around them. And the third book is about guys who are in college trying to, you know, they're learning the rules of how to do it. And the fourth book, Trio of Lost Souls, is those same archetypes, but now aged. They're wiser, they're older, they're flawed. And so I have all those characteristics that make a single human being spread out through four books with all different characters. Okay. So the idea was to try to write a quartet that doesn't have recurring characters as such. You can bring them back, but that doesn't. I didn't want to do a standard, you know, Alexandria, you know,
Tyrell
kind of thing, you know, or a Proust kind of thing. I wanted. Can I write a modern American quartet using American characters? And this is why I love, you know, Hush Now, Don't Explain. I mean, that is a quintessential American. It could not have been written in Germany by an immigrant. It could not have been. It could only have been written by Dennis Must from Pennsylvania. That's what I wanted to do with the quartet. Can I write a specifically American one? And I think in Valley Boy, you know, I fuse, in a way, some of the same things that you have worked with in Hush Now, Don't Explain and World's Smallest Boy, is how do culture and religion in America fit together with the adolescent dream of becoming free and real and becoming your own person? And that's what I was trying to do. So I found a totally different experience and had to wait for a long time between, you know, drafts of those things so the characters could actually mature and my style could catch up with the characters. And it took a long time.
Yeah, because sometimes I say, I ask people, what do you want to, like I feel myself, I'm like, what do I want to be when I grow up? I mean, it's like, you don't, it's like when you're writing, you don't feel a certain age, it doesn't matter what the age is, you're just writing, and you're not a certain age, you know. So I think that, you know, as you say, years on, you do develop a different thought process sometimes, even the same characters, because that's why you're going to, both of you, if you watch this Olive Kitteridge, you will see, this is what the story, I've not seen anything like this on TV where they did that. So, I mean, it was just brilliant. And that's what they did with it. It kept changing some different characters and different parts of her life, and which is what we have. We do have a life like that. Our lives change. We don't, you know, you don't always see the change, but sometimes you look back and you go, oh, my God, look what happened then.
Oh, absolutely.
What I had to wait for in Trio, I've been writing on that. I'm pretty sure I was writing on that since about 2005. But what I had to wait for in Trio was for this romance that I have with style to work its way out.
Yeah.
So that the thing I wanted in Trio, no, the thing that came to me in Trio finally was, this is a book whose style is essentially to have no style. In other words, in the Book of Changes and in Deification and in Valley Boy, there's definitely a style of writing. And yet in Trio, what I wanted to do and what I knew I wanted to do was to write from the inside of these men in deep anguish about the mistakes that they've made with their lives. And you can't do that if you're doing a pulse writing, or what I mean by pulse writing, where the language is sort of, it's got its own rhythm and its own impulse to it. So in Trio, it's stripped down, and it's all just pure, as close as I can get to pure emotion, you know.
Would you go back when you're writing? Do you go back and go forward again, or do you, like, after you finish writing, do you go back somewhat and read it and see if you like it, or do you just keep finishing it?
Well, that is a question, I think, about what we mean by drafts in the computer culture.
Yeah.
What is a draft? You know,
right.
I mean, we can see, used to be in the old days when you were typing, if you changed a page, you had to retype, a lot.
Oh, boy.
You know? Well, you know, now with computers, what's a draft? I mean, you know, good grief. You know, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So, well, this is my first draft. Well, then, certainly in the theater, Dennis, when Bob and I taught screenwriting, we learned that in the screenwriting world, the first draft is not the first draft, but it's the first, it could be the 50th time you've been through a script, but it's the first time you dare put it on the table for somebody else to look at.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that the first draft in theater world, too?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Go ahead.
Just one comment about that is that finally when that script was done, more or less, right, and I would give it to the actors, right? But then it was just the beginning, and that's Jack and I talked about the collaborative experience.
Yeah.
Then it was, okay, now let's look at all these pages you've written here and all these, you know, dialogue and that. Let's find the line through. Where's that stream, you know? Where's the heart of this thing? Where's the pulse? I want to feel the pulse. And every rehearsal would look for that. Well, I'll take this out. It's too far away from the pulse.
Yeah.
And so, then the work was beginning to come to fruition, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I love
it. So it's a long performance
draft. Do you still write plays?
No, the sad part about that is, and you know, Jack and I have talked about that. I miss it a lot because I felt like I was. Despite how I love writing novels and all of this, and I do, but I do miss being in a collaborative experience where two people can put their arms around each other and say, look what we've done. You know?
I know.
There's something about that you can't be duplicated in one study by themselves.
Right.
No,
the thing I miss about the theater. But I don't, I don't have actors or anything anymore, so that's how I got into this business.
Yeah.
Well, this is what I get to with the poetry group. I meet once a month with a group called the Third Sunday Group, and they're all very accomplished people. In fact, you know, I mean, they've done things that I can't even imagine. But one of the things that we keep coming back to is it possible to work in a group like that and still maintain your individuality as a writer, as a poet? And the answer is yes. If you share a common aesthetic, you realize that it can take so many different forms, but at the same time, you're actually working at a depth level that you could not ever come to alone just by bringing the poems to the group and saying, here it is.
Yes.
Here's my soul, you know, stomp on me, whatever you want to do.
Yes, yes.
And never taking work to the group that you know is finished. Only take work to the group that you know needs a set of eyes, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, because that's true. Because, you know, I mean, you know, that is a problem. Like people now, I don't know if you, a lot of people, we've had on the shows here, Virginia's had, my partner in the World of Ink, we've had people on that they're talking about anthologies that they've done, but they've done them differently. They are actually the same story, but in different places, but they have to blend together. All these people, let's say 6 or 8 people writing stories that make the whole anthology end right. And they fought, did fight. They fight with each other and they don't like each other, but then they do like each other and they met, you know, because they're authors trying to get their voice out, but there's 8 of them. That's hard.
Yeah.
That's
very,
very
hard.
Yeah. But at the end, they seemed satisfied with that. But they all, a few of them said they wouldn't do it again. But some of them said they would. You know, I think that's very difficult to work a book, like a whole anthology, where you're using their, you know, everybody's using the same characters and getting to the same place. It's in different genres sometimes, too. They carried it through. That's hard. I think. I don't think I'd want to.
Well, Dennis, do you have anybody that you work with at the moment, or is it all pretty much yourself? You know, do you have anybody who reads your stuff at different levels or different phases?
Well, it's one of the things that makes me very gratified that I've met you.
There you go.
That once this new work is done, it's going to send it to Seattle.
Yeah, right.
But yes, I do have a couple of writer, long term writer friends that whose opinion I respect dearly.
Well, let me ask you both a question then. Is critique in America in this decade of the 21st century a destructive or a creative process?
My answer? I think destructive. I don't feel that a lot of times I see a lot of people where they're changing everything. You can't sometimes change it just because someone tells you to change it. It doesn't work, you know, and that's what I see happening to people, where they're having so many people read it, and, you know, that to me it would be destructive. I don't think I could do that. And I'll give you an example that I just put a couple of my scripts just to see. I put them on Amazon Studios, and so I just thought, but then you can put it privately, or you can put it publicly. And I put it privately because publicly people can go into your script and change it. And I don't think that would work for me. It's not going to happen. Right. You know, I couldn't write like that. I don't even know who that would be. You know what I mean? So, and I don't know who they are. So I think that that would matter to me. Like, let's say that Dennis said he's sending work to you, and if you give him something constructive, that's different, because you are giving him advice that you're established,
you know,
and you're
very...
I think
it gets down to trust. You know, I think it gets down to trust.
Yeah, it is.
This time.
It's
and the word that I really do not like is people come in and they say, well, I really like this, but.
But.
You know, that but tells me everything, you know. Because they're not saying something like, well, I think your dialogue needs work, or your character settings need, or your character descriptions, or you got too much time here and not enough time. You know, those are really objective criteria that help me as a writer come to grips with the story that I'm trying to get. Or, see, I keep saying I. I come to grips with the story that wants to get out. And I got to train myself constantly to say, this isn't you, buddy. I mean, this is the story speaking.
I know.
It were that simple, you know. I mean, so it's a matter of trust, finding people that you can trust to read the stuff and give you some objective criteria. Yeah. You know, your dialogue, you got nothing but a series of monologues, you know. You got serial monologues. That's not dialogue, you know.
Right.
So it's that kind of stuff that helps me, and that's why I'm really suspect of most critique. You know, Dennis, what's your read on all that?
Well, very early on, when I wrote a novel that I thought was finished, and I said, I have to find somebody who really knows about writing and who's published, and I did find somebody, an editor who's quite well known, actually. And I worked with that person probably close to a year, and over a number of drafts, as it were. And I accepted everything that person said. When the book was done, it really was his book and it wasn't mine.
Yeah.
And that's when despite his recognition in literary circles, et cetera, I thought, I can't, you know, I can't go down this path anymore.
Right.
Right.
And
I totally agree.
What I do now is And it's why, one of the reasons why Jack and I have become friends is that as I read his work, I think, oh my God, I understand that. It feels like something I may have, pieces that I have may have written. You know, I've come to the same place.
Let me, Mark,
and so then I said,
so
this is, we call each other,
Dennis,
you
and
know.
I joke that we're brothers in the word.
Yeah.
There's a story.
And so, and that's the trust we're talking about.
Yeah,
so he understands the music,
yes,
you know.
Yes,
that's sort of
that's
what
true.
It is, you know.
Yeah, it's true. Because I know if my Jeff has been my editor for all the years that I've been writing, and it's like I know if he tells me something and if there's a problem, I always agree because I know that he's right because I felt it, but when he told me, then it really made it, this is it. And, you know,
yeah.
He doesn't do it for me. He doesn't redo it. He tells me what he thinks is wrong, and I redo it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that makes me feel if somebody's doing, like you were saying, I don't want somebody writing for me. Like
right.
You felt
yes,
that book wasn't yours.
I've often thought, Marcia and Jack, is that if I have one person that I trust, really trust,
right. Yeah.
And be honest with myself, that
yeah.
audience of one is enough. It's sufficient,
yeah.
you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
let
so,
what
yeah.
else come.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I kind of
no,
agree,
I
with,
agree
you know,
with that. 100%.
I mean, to me,
yeah.
this is what people, I hope they're listening, and I will put it out more so people to hear this. But the truth is, these are such good things for writers to hear. I don't care how many years you're writing, you've never heard enough. So, I mean, when you're hearing
right,
from two
right.
accomplished people like Dennis and Jack, you realize, you know, that this is what it's about.
Yeah.
Listening to you
yeah.
is the real thing. It really is,
yeah.
you know. And
well,
I think
you know,
this, I think that will help people.
Yeah, we did that show with Joanne, you know, for a long
yeah.
time.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
And we used to do timed writing, Dennis. We'd do
yeah.
timed writing on the air. And that,
oh, really?
That was really good. Yeah, because we
wow.
were able to, we'd read it, you know, out loud like that. And that got us into a whole different way of thinking about it. Instead of people bringing their work and reading it and saying, you know,
yeah.
isn't this great, we'd
yeah.
do it raw. And then they
yeah.
would
wow.
read it, and often they would discover things
about
in
themselves.
The writing
yeah.
Yeah. yeah, that was just so good, you know. Anyway.
Well, I don't think Jackie
realized,
I mean, you are a great teacher. I mean, you may think you're not teaching, but you are. You have taught so many people after years of teaching school. You have taught so many authors. By your blog, you
uh-huh.
should mention your blog is wonderful, Bob and Jack's blog.
Oh, yeah.
And, yes.
Yeah.
And we've had Bob
yeah.
on
well,
once. That was fun
been,
with
yeah,
Bob. We have to get Bob on again. We'll have to have him come on again.
Yeah, what we've been doing there lately is doing interviews with various, you know, other writers.
Yeah.
To try to, mainly there are people who have worked with us doing those kinds of techniques that we talk
yeah.
about, you know, the
yeah.
time writing and those kinds of things. And over the years, a great many of them have been very successful. And so we kind of wanted to show other people what happens when you submit to the discipline. And I know
yeah.
that sounds awfully Islamic and stuff, you know.
No,
but,
you have to, somewhat,
yeah.
yes.
But Dennis is a very disciplined writer. I mean, nothing
yes.
he writes everything he writes shows the earmarks of that discipline and that
yeah.
real close attention to words, you know,
yeah.
that make the thing. So we
but
try
I think, don't
to
you think,
enforce,
about being a playwright, don't you think when you know how to, like you do screenwriting too, Jack, you've done that. And if you do that, I think that's a big help in writing because I think that helps you see a lot. When I know
yeah.
from my screenwriting, I became a better writer from that, but in the middle when
yeah.
I did the screenwriting. I think it helps because
yeah.
your words, you know, like I think you'll understand when I have written, like if I write a screenplay and I'm writing, one line does not make that I don't like it, I will redo it. I don't care how long it
right.
takes me. If it doesn't sound right, I will keep redoing
yeah.
it till I get that to sound right. And that's where
yeah.
I learned a lot of things from doing screenplays. Which, so I'm sure
yeah.
Dennis
well,
has
I
learned
a
lot from plays.
I did a novel called Lemon Custard. And at that time, what I was trying to do was to see if there's a technique that can make me a better novelist. And I found exactly what you just said. I would write the novel and then redo it as a screenplay and then use the screenplay as a model or a template
yeah,
for rewriting
yeah.
the novel.
Yeah.
And what happened was everything became clearer. know, the storylines became clear, the dialogue, the character, everything became clear because I got rid of all the words and reduced it quite simply to a set of actions and images.
Yeah.
And then the dialogue grew out of that. And as a finished novel, it's much, much better than it was in its one of its original drafts. So I think changing media like that is really a good thing
too.
To do.
Yeah. I do, too. I think this has been very interesting. I want, you know, it's really, you know, it's so good to talk just like this and not, you know, because I think this is what, these are the basics. These are what everybody needs, you know, and just talking about it reassures us that we could keep going on because sometimes you wonder if you could keep, you go, can I keep going on?
Yeah.
Will I be able to write something? And you do, you know, it comes out and then you get that aha moment.
If you get a chance, Marcia,
dig
up Dennis's book of short stories. What's it called?
What's it called?
Short story.
Banjo Grease.
Okay.
Yes, that's
okay.
it. You know,
right.
That's
get
the one
I
said.
That.
Yeah.
Okay.
That is, I love that whole collection because it shows me everything that a writer needs to know about writing short stories.
Yeah.
You know, and what it indicates to me, and I know this is getting into a mutual, you know, admiration society here, but every now and then you discover a writer who can teach you something no matter how well-versed
that's
you
right.
think you
exactly.
already are.
Exactly. That's good. That's because your mind is open
for
it.
Stories, his book of short stories is just one of those models of how to write short stories, and I just love it, you know, and I wish
it's hard to
people...
I think short stories are very difficult to write. I've never written any till I wrote my Virginia. I've never written a short story, and it's not easy. I think it's really hard. I don't think people realize how hard it is.
Yeah, very difficult, you know.
All right, so I thank you for being on. This has been really good. Dennis, I hope you will come back, and we didn't scare you off. You'll come back.
It's been wonderful. It's wonderful.
Oh, good. After the first of the year, I'm making some new shows, so you'll come because you're very interesting. And Jack, thank you for introducing me to Dennis. Yeah, and Jack knows how Jack is great. I mean, Jack, we all love you, Jack. You know that. Virginia's not here today, but you know, we do. You learn so much.
I mean, you teach us a lot.
Thank you. You really do. And every breath you take, you have some advice coming out of you.
Well, you know, I was just in, speaking of all that, I did a couple workshops up at the League of Utah Writers Conference last September, and I opened it up with them trying to get them to become aware of rhetoric. And I said, look, you may not know it, but when Stephen Stills wrote this song here, if you're not with the one you love, love the one you're with. Well, so that's a chiasmus, folks. You know, that's a stent, that's about 3,000 years old as a literary device. And here he is using it in this rock and roll song. You know, well, that's what we need more of, you know, is an understanding of who we are and where we came from, how we got here. And everything like that. And that's what
sometimes
I try
we never
to
know.
Teach, so.
You don't know. So many things as you're writing, you do learn about yourself. I think that writing teaches you a lot about yourself.
Exactly.
And, you know, because even as a kid, I was never very patient. But when you're a writer, you have to be patient because it just does not come out. It just doesn't come out in one piece. It would be nice, but it's not happening that way.
Exactly.
You know, we get it in different modes.
Well, look,
right, thank you so much.
Are you trying to get us off here, Marcia?
Well, you can stay on here forever. But it's also because
it's
Dennis.
I've got to go eat some dinner. My wife
Dennis,
is holding dinner for me.
It's almost 10:30 already.
It was great, you guys. I had a good time.
Okay, it was wonderful. Thank you.
And
have a happy, healthy New Year, everybody, and a good Thanksgiving. And I don't think I'll be on unless I just...
Let us know how you're doing with your thyroid condition.
Take care of your health.
I'll be fine, you know. But it's just that, you know, you got to go to doctors every now and then. It happens to all of us, unfortunately.
Good night, y'all.
Good night, everybody. Good night. Bye, Dennis.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Jack. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Jack.
Bye-bye.